The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Bartley presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today via teleconference by Judge Allen and Judge Falvey. We're here today for the consolidated matters of Charles L. Swanigan versus Robert L. Wilkie, docket number 19-1350 Big E, and Jesse B. Turman versus Robert L. Wilkie, docket number 19-3258 Big E. The issues before us involve the appropriate hourly rate for reimbursement under the Aegis statute for one of the veterans attorneys who worked on these cases from Quito, Ecuador. Counsel for the parties, please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel.
Hi, my name is Harold Hoffman, and I'm joined with Megan Gentile, or Mr. Swanigan and Turman.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. And Secretary Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Brandon Callahan. With me today on the line is Deputy Chief Counsel Christopher Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Callahan. As you know, each party has 30 minutes to present arguments. Mr. Hoffman, how much time for rebuttal?
10 minutes, please, Your Honor.
Okay, that's fine. We will make that happen. And Mr. Hoffman, you may proceed when ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, for the third time in 3 years, this court has to answer what to do with attorneys billing from a non-traditional office. In Parrott, one attorney is billing from multiple offices around the United States. In Spegner, two attorneys were working remotely but billing from their firm's home office in Washington, D.C. Here, I have billed for time that I performed while in Quito, Ecuador. Even before COVID, more and more attorneys were teleworking. COVID has just fast-forwarded that virtual office movement. Attorneys practicing in this court without changing their practice much at all can put down roots anywhere they want or not put down roots at all. Our offices are wherever there's Wi-Fi and a laptop. The Aegis goal is to provide litigants with sufficient purchasing power to hire attorneys in suits against the government for unjust government action. Congress started with a national rate, $125, and provided that the rate should increase with cost of living increases. But Congress did not dictate how to calculate that rate. And the circuit courts differ on what rates to use and how to calculate that rate. The agreement between the courts, though, is that a cost of living increase is necessary because not increasing the rate would frustrate Aegis' intent by decreasing litigants' purchasing power. My enhanced rate request follows this court's holdings in El Cizan, Manino, and Spegner. I use the El Cizan formula for the location as per Manino, where I perform the work according to Spegner. If the secretary thinks attorneys can't receive enhanced Aegis rates for work performed outside the United States because he doesn't think that we can support an enhanced rate.
Mr. Hoffman, this is Judge Allen. Are you aware of any federal court that has addressed the issue of cost of living increases with respect to Aegis or work performed outside the United States one way or the other?
I have not found any, Your Honor, and we have hired a research assistant, and we have used a law librarian, and no one has found anything thus far.
Thanks very much.
The Secretary argues that it cannot support an enhanced rate, quote, due to the significant complexity involved in demonstrating the cost of living in a foreign country. He argues that a rate increase is unavailable because computing, quote, the cost of living in a foreign country is unworkable. His claim is that the data using data from outside the United States is unavailable, unreliable, and unsound. But that's not the case. Almost every country computes a CPI based on the same or very similar methods to the United States, including Ecuador. The Secretary argues the data is unreliable or unsound only because it was not from the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics. The cost of living data I chose is from Ecuador's BLS equivalent, the United Nations and Department of Defense, all reliable sources. The Secretary argues that the Elcizan method is unworkable and that equating a cost of living in a foreign country is too complicated. I don't think it is. I started with the Elcizan formula using DC CPI data. I calculated the percentage difference in the cost of living for DC and Quito using the UN index. I took those two numbers and I multiplied them to get the percentage difference between DC and Quito's current cost of living. I provided Ecuador's CPI data to also show that the cost of living in Quito has increased by almost 1,500%. So there has been a cost of living increase. I can show what the cost of living is using reliable data. I've carried my burden proving that an enhanced rate is warranted for work performed in Quito, Ecuador. Congress intended for enhanced rates to be provided when the cost of living increases and to match a cost of living sufficiently enough for litigants to maintain their purchasing power. The court should reaffirm its holding in Manino that when local CPI data is unavailable, EJIA applicants can use different sources, and that is the broadest reading of the Manino holding. Alternatively, we ask the court to expand on Manino and Spechner to allow applicants to use the national rate when CPI data is unavailable. Finally, we request the court to consider our argument that this court switched to the Ninth Circuit's method. The court has answered this in the past and chose the locality rate, but there's no evidence that a national rate would provide more windfalls or misfortunes than the local and regional rates, and it would be far more efficient than litigating over these midpoints and locality selections, the third time in just a few years that the court has had to answer this question, at least, and as I showed in my attachments, we're constantly dealing with a barrage of emails to knock off $2, $3, $4, or $5 because of a few cents on some rate.
Mr. Hoffman, this is Judge Bartley. Just as to your latter point there, we can't make the change that you're requesting, that we just change to a national number, you know, for everyone, right? We can't do that as a panel. You would agree with that?
Yes, I believe if the court were to switch to a national rate, it would have to do it in bonk.
Okay, I just wanted to be clear on that. And also, you spend a bit of time in your, I think it was in your reply document, talking about why you moved to Quito in your opening office to serve veterans who are in South America. I mean, why is it relevant why you are living in Quito? Couldn't you just, hey, I like the mountain air or something? do we need to know why you're there?
Look, there's two reasons. I do a lot of agency work also. We do our agency work pro bono or low bono, and we fund that through our EJIA fees and by taking smaller salaries. There are a lot of veterans that are currently in Ecuador and around South America, Your Honor.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I get that. But you started out your argument by saying that people can work from anywhere, presumably not only because the attorney has access to tech, but also because their clients by and large have access to tech and can accept calls from their attorneys from anywhere and maybe even do video calls. So why does it matter that there are veterans in South America? I'm going back to my original question, I guess. Why does that matter? Why does the distance between the attorney and the client matter in these days? And is it relevant to our EJIA question?
I don't think it's actually relevant to the EJIA question, Your Honor. I do think that some of our clients, especially clients in the agency, often do like to meet with us and have a conference or a meeting, an interview. Those can be done over the phone. It's it's beneficial often to do it in person. It's easier to have a back and forth. But another reason I'm moving to Ecuador is simply because I want to. It is twofold. It's not going to help my business. It will help some veterans, the ones that really prefer to sit in with their attorney and have an interview. And it might help them, and that I might glean more information than I would over the phone. But ultimately, this is a personal choice more than a business choice.
Okay, I appreciate the honesty of that answer. Moving on, though, to the formula that you you used in your EJIA application. You asked that we consider the average of VOD and UN cost of living indices. Why wouldn't you just pick one of those? I think you said something about it seemed fairer to do an average, which I also question. Like, can you explain that a little more, why you didn't just go with one or the other? And in addition, if you were forced to choose between one or the other, which would you choose and why?
Your Honor, so I average them because there's always problems with all data, including the BLS data we use. The BLS has said the data that they're providing isn't fully accurate, and especially regional data is less accurate than national data. Here, and that's due to sample size. I only have these two sets of data. If every number in the UN and the DOD indices and the BLS numbers were accurate, everything was perfect, we would come to the same number, and we would know that number is correct. But we don't, because there's always flaws in the numbers, and I'm looking at three different number sets when I can include the two different rates. Averaging them, it's not as much about fairness, I guess, as it is about ensuring that we're closer to the most accurate rate. It changes the sample size. It doubles it to ensure that the rate is more likely to be accurate. If I could choose one, I would choose the higher rate simply because it's a higher rate. I don't know
that one is more accurate than the other. Mr. Hoffman, that's the DOD. Am I correct in that?
I think so. I think the DOD rate came out higher.
Okay.
But it's impossible to know which number is more accurate between the – I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off, Your Honor.
Yeah, so you would choose the higher rate just because it's higher?
Yes, Your Honor, just because it's higher. The reality is, which number is more accurate? I don't know if anyone could figure that out. I mean, we're feeding other calculations, including the BLS calculation, into it. And the reason averaging is by using the law of averages, more likely that number, if it's off, at least it's only going to be off half instead of a full $15 one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Hoffman, doesn't EJIA essentially require that we use the lower of two potential rates, the prevailing market rate for the kind of service you're providing, or the $125 per hour plus a cost of living adjustment? You didn't make any statement, I don't believe, I could be wrong, in your EJIA application about the prevailing market rate. And I guess I have some questions about that.
Yes.
Would be the prevailing market rate that you would propose would apply here?
And Your Honor, please go ahead, Your Honor.
Go ahead. Yeah, so what would be the prevailing market rate that you would use, or that you were saying the 125 is the lower?
Yes, Your Honor. The prevailing market, so the market is still, the market isn't Ecuadorian attorneys. They're not even allowed to practice in this court under Rule 46. You have to be admitted to practice in the United States. That's Rule 46 of this court's rules. I'm sorry. The market is still here in the United States. The prevailing market rate is probably the one found on the Laffey Matrix for Washington, D.C. attorneys, since that's where the court is. I think it's important to look at what is the market. And the market isn't, when I go to Ecuador, my market doesn't just change to Ecuador because I am the market. I will be likely the only attorney there who's practicing in U.S. courts, litigating, I should say. There's going to be, of course, corporate attorneys there.
And so you would use, as the prevailing market rate, your billing rate, not in Quito, but in the U.S.?
Yes, Your Honor, because my clients will be American. Well, they don't necessarily have to be Americans, but they will be veterans or their family members. They will, the practice will be in, it will be litigation in an American court. And I am an American barred in America. An Ecuadorian isn't going to be able to come and hire me to deal with his or her insurance claim. My market is still in America. Or anyone who's hiring me, the market they're looking at, is still going to be in America.
Thank you.
Unless the court has any more questions for me, I will go ahead and mute my phone and listen to the secretary.
Judge Allen, do you have any further questions?
No, I don't. Thanks.
And Judge Falvey, do you have any questions?
I do not. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. And Mr. Callahan, you may proceed when ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. I'd like to begin by addressing Judge Allen's question. No court in the country has done what appellant's counsel is asking this court to do. No court has held that the cost of living provisions of Section 2412 can be applied to determine the hourly rate for an attorney based in a locality outside of the United States. This is because of the immense conceptual and technical difficulties associated with applying the statute in this way. So I'd like
Mr.
to begin
Callahan. Excuse me, this is Judge Falvey. I'm having a little trouble hearing you, and I don't think it's on my end because I had no trouble hearing Mr. Hoffman or Judge Allen or Judge Bartley.
Apologize.
Yeah, this is Judge. This is Judge Allen. I also am having difficulty. You're fading out at the end of almost every sentence.
I apologize, Your Honors. Is that a little better?
Thank you. That's much better.
Yes, it is.
Okay, I apologize. There's a headset difficulties. As I was saying, no court in the country has done what appellant's counsel is asking this court to do. This is because there are immense conceptual and technical difficulties associated with applying the statute.
Mr. Callahan, could I jump in? This is Judge Allen for one point. It's on this point about the fact that no court has done this. No court, as far as I know, and I think you've confirmed it, no court has addressed this issue one way or the other, right?
That's correct, you know. Your Honor. Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. As far as I've been able to determine, no court has ever specifically addressed a request like this, but that's because the other courts that would at least regularly deal with attorneys living and working outside of the United States use a very different construction of the aegis statutes.
What do you mean by that? Mr. Callahan?
This is Judge Falvey. I can hear Judge Allen, but no one else.
This is Harold.
Michael, has Mr. Callahan dropped off? Oh, okay, so we'll wait for a few minutes and see if they come back on.
Yes, this is Brandon Callahan. I apologize.
Okay. Mr. Callahan, did you hear? Yeah, did you hear Judge Allen's question?
I did hear Judge Allen's question. In response, Judge Allen, I would say, yes, you're correct that no court that I'm aware of has ever specifically addressed a request of the type that appellant counsel is presenting. But that's because the courts that at least would regularly deal with attorneys who live and work outside of the United States use a very different construction of the aegis statute than this court uses. Specifically, the Court of International Trade uses a construction based around the location of the filing of the suit. And so because that court sits in New York, they use the Northeast CPIU information. A similar situation happens in most of the immigration cases. They again use the location of the filing. So whether the attorney lives and works in Ecuador or New York, if they file the suit in the Southern District of California, they'll be using the West Urban Rate. So no court has ever specifically addressed a request like this, but that appears to be because no court uses a construction of the kind that this court uses. That being said, I would like to just endorse this court's construction in Elsiz and Menino. Specifically, I would note that the Federal Circuit has approved this construction in Perot. They said that the Elsiz and Menino formulation, I believe the language they used was better fulfills the purposes of the aegis statute.
Mr. Callahan, could I ask one question? Do you I understand that you contest the methodology that the appellant uses, but I want to just step back. Is the Secretary's position that the aegis statute does not allow, as a categorical matter, an adjustment of a cost of living based on an out-of-country location?
Yes, Your Honor. I thank you for that question. I would like to clarify that we do not believe that appellant's counsel has carried his burden in this case. We also believe that the context and the unworkable nature of the request suggest that the cost of living provision of Section 2412 cannot be applied to an attorney living and working outside of the United States. In having this discussion, I think
Is there something in the statute that gives you that, or is it just that let's just assume, because doing so is difficult, that therefore Congress did not intend it? And the reason I'm asking this question is that the statute itself doesn't appear to say anything one way or the other. And, you know, I doubt Congress was thinking about this, frankly, at the time. But if you think that there's a part of the statute that one can get there, if you could identify that. If not, I understand your workability argument.
Yes, Your Honor. To be clear, we read nothing specifically in the statute, in the words of the statute, that prevent the cost of living provision from being applied to an attorney living and working outside of the United States. However, as I say, the unworkable nature of the request suggests that this is not to be applied to an international attorney. I would also point out that the context of the statute further suggests that, as you say, this is not what Congress had in mind when the statute was passed. Specifically, I note that the statute was originally passed in October of 1981. To reference appellant's counsel's note that his office is anywhere that there is Wi-Fi and a laptop, the World Wide Web did not become publicly available for the first time until August of 1991. And obviously, this court did not begin to use the internet as its primary means of doing business until October of 2008. So it's very likely that Congress could not have conceived of what appellant's counsel is now seeking to do, because his living and working in Ecuador and representing veterans in American courts would have been very much more difficult, if not altogether impossible, in October of 1981. I think it's also important to remember that the aegis statute contains no provision for the extension of a claimant's time to file an application, and it makes no discussion of service or mailing of that application, which would seem to be extremely relevant for someone with an attorney living and working outside of the United States. So as I say, this context suggests that Congress likely did not have in mind what appellant's counsel is seeking to do, and this context is borne out in the unworkable nature of the application of the cost of living provision to an attorney in a situation such as appellant's counsel. Here, I think it's important to remember that we're talking about attorneys that are living and working in countries other than just Ecuador. The Secretary's office is already aware of attorneys who either have or are expected to practice in front of this court who live and work outside of the United States in a country other than Ecuador. And so this case and the precedent set here today will affect those cases as well. Primarily, when I speak of this unworkable nature of the request, I'm speaking of three particular points: data, policy, and complexity. In terms of data, I think everyone can agree that it's important to have available and reliable data. Appellant's counsel has provided us in his reply pleading with data that he says he obtained from the Ecuadorian government. To be absolutely clear, the Secretary takes no position on the reliability of that data. Secretary's only point is that neither Congress nor this court has taken a position on the reliability of that data, and the reliability is crucial to the cost of living calculations. And because we don't have any endorsement from Congress of the Ecuadorian government's calculations, it would fall to this court to make that judgment for itself. That is, with respect, a task which this court has never taken up and would be a very complicated task to ensure. I think it would also greatly increase the risk of secondary litigation, because assessing the reliability of the data would require the court to consider things that again, with respect, have never been considered before, such as statistical analyses, collection methodologies, and even survey practices, potentially. So we have this question of reliability, but even if the court were able to determine that the data was available and reliable, it's important to remember that CPI information of the kind that Appellant's counsel has provided can't be used to compare the cost of living in two locations. So we can't use the Ecuadorian CPI information that he's provided to compare to the cost of living in DC or anywhere else in the country. We can only use it to compare the change in the cost of living in Ecuador over time. And so this is really important, because when we apply that data in a statistically sound way, following the formulations of El-Sizen and Mania, we come to a rate of over $1,600. As Appellant's counsel has said in his initial application, that can't be correct. That seems a facially unreasonable rate. The reason that we come to such an unreasonable rate is because the policy concerns that underlie the statute aren't satisfied when we apply the statute to an attorney living and working outside of the United States. The legislative history of Section 2412 is very clear that in passing the $125 statutory maximum, Congress was seeking to find a compromise position between two competing interests. I believe that the language that Appellant's counsel used was the purchasing power of the individual. On the one hand, Congress was trying to ensure that the individual could go out and find sufficiently competent representation in the case before the United States. I think as a relevant aside here, it's important to keep in mind that Congress was simply looking to provide monies for sufficiently competent representation, not, say, expertly competent representation. So there is a policy judgment that was made by Congress about what level is sufficiently competent for the goals of the statute. That interest was then compromised alongside the interest of protecting the taxpayer from the potentially astronomical costs of a program that would provide for attorney's fees. So what we have in the $125 statutory maximum is a judgment from Congress that as a matter of policy, $125 an hour was, as of March of 1996, sufficient money for an individual to go out and hire sufficiently competent legal counsel in a case before the United States. I should say against the United States. The problem here is that we have no similar policy judgment made from Congress about any other country. We have no statement about whether $125 an hour is, was, or continues to be sufficient money for an individual to go out and find sufficiently competent legal counsel in any country other than the United States. And so we would need to determine that the policy goals of the statute are not satisfied by the $125 statutory maximum in order to apply the cost of living increase to an attorney living outside of the United States, in order to ensure that that attorney was not receiving a windfall. The problem with this is that that is a policy judgment made by Congress, and so Congress is the best source of the answer for this question, but we have no answer from them. To the extent that the court would seek to ensure the policy judgments or policy considerations of the statute are satisfied in this case, the Secretary would submit that, again, that's something best done by Congress, but that when the court does attempt to step in, we run into a great deal of complexity. Here in particular,
Mr. Callahan, this is Judge Bartley.
Yes.
But you do admit that the language of the statute is fairly simple and straightforward, and dare I say, clear. Attorney's fees shall not be awarded in excess of $125 per hour unless the court determines that an increase in the cost of living justifies a higher fee.
So yes, Your Honor.
You're talking about Congress's policy considerations, but what went into the statute was a very simple statement that you don't go over 125 unless the court determines that an increase is justified.
Yes, Your Honor. I would agree that the language in the statute is, as you say, rather simple, and that there's nothing in the statute that would specifically prevent application of the statute to an attorney living and working outside of the United States. This is all to back up Judge Allen's point that it appears that Congress could not have conceived of what Appellant's counsel is now seeking to do. And so when you attempt to apply the statute in a way that is outside what Congress was seeking to do, the entire thing kind of crumbles, because you either wind up with an unreasonable hourly rate like $1,600 an hour, or you wind up having to fabricate an entirely new methodology that, quite frankly, doesn't seem statistically and mathematically sound, or has, in the case of Appellant's national annual proposal that he raised in his reply pleading, has already been specifically rejected by this court, and the rejection of that system has been endorsed by the Federal Circuit. So I agree that there's nothing particularly in the words of the statute, but I do think that the congressional intent is very clear and that the policy concerns are very relevant, particularly because when we don't have a guarantee of the satisfaction of those policy concerns, we end up with an hourly rate that kind of runs amok at $1,600 an hour. So I do think that it's important for the court to ensure that both the purchasing power goal and the protection of the taxpayer goal of the statute would be satisfied. In essence, I think the court needs to determine that $125 an hour would not be enough for someone to go out in Ecuador and hire what Congress deemed to be sufficiently competent legal counsel right now. That is not at all clear from appellant's pleadings, and quite frankly, I'm unsure how any appellant could ever provide that kind of information. This is all to kind of say nothing of the increase. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Callahan, let's assume that the court decides that COLAs are available for work performed outside the U.S. What method should the court use to calculate the appropriate increase?
I apologize, Your Honor.
I'm ordering you to take my assumption.
Very well, Your Honor. I apologize that I don't have a very clear answer for Your Honor's question, because I do think that at least any of the systems that I can conceive of or that appellant's counsel have provided are flawed in one way or the other. I think that of the methods that have been contemplated, as appellant's counsel says, the use of the national standard is perhaps the most principled, because of the holding in Menino and the unavailability potentially of more local data that is, as I say, available and reliable and satisfying the policy concerns of the statute. The problem with the adoption of the national CPI standard for attorneys living outside the United States is that that system has already been rejected by this court in Menino for attorneys living, at least for attorneys living inside the United States. And so there appears to be no inherent logic to allowing a system for international attorneys, which has already been rejected for domestic attorneys, particularly because there are many domestic attorneys for whom the use of the national rate would be advantageous to them financially, and that system is not available to them via Menino. So if I had to pick one, take Your Honor's assumption, that seems to be the most principled, but I do think that it suffers from serious complications, particularly in terms of this court's jurisprudence. As I say, the policy concerns that underlie all of this, when the court tries to step in and make sure that those considerations are satisfied, we wind up in an incredibly complicated and complex set of calculations. Particularly here, I'm talking about exchange rates. I understand that exchange rates are not at issue in this case because the official currency of Ecuador is the U.S. dollar. That is not the case for most countries. And as I say, the Secretary's office is already aware of attorneys in other countries who either have or may be practicing in front of this court. And so exchange rates will affect them. The problem with exchange rates is that they're incredibly dynamic and actually change minute to minute. And so up to this point, the court's jurisprudence has required that the parties go down to the year and month of the work performed to obtain the midpoint. Now, conceivably, we'd be going down to the year, month, day, potentially even hour or minute to get the actual exchange rate. That's a very complicated, fine point to find. That's to say nothing of the source of that information. There is no particular source of exchange rate information that is endorsed widely or even by the U.S. government. There are some sources from the U.S. government that maintain exchange rate information, but those sources are not unified. They do not appear to contain exchange rate information for every country in the world. And even the IRS suggests that parties go to private companies sometimes to obtain exchange rate information for their IRS filings. And so there's a very big question about source.
Mr. Callahan, this is Judge Bartley, but you did begin this whole lengthy argument, right, that you're making about exchange rates, basically by saying that it's not an issue for Mr. Swanigan's or Mr. Terman's case.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. As I say, the official currency of Ecuador is the U.S. dollar, but because this case will affect attorneys who are living and working in countries other than Ecuador or the United States, the consideration is still, I think, very relevant. So there's a very big question about source and about how specific we would need to get with exchange rates. I think it's also important to remember that the exchange rates would have to be applied twice, because we would have to take the $125 statutory maximum, convert it into the local currency as of March of 1996, and only then could we perform the cost of living calculations on that number before converting it back to U.S. dollars as of some point for payment. This is an absolutely necessary step because we have to ensure that we're accounting for the change in the relative value of one currency to another over time. And so if we don't apply it at both time periods, we would be negating that mathematical principle. So that injects a high degree of complexity. It also raises the question of when we would convert back into U.S. dollars. It's unclear if we would convert back to U.S. dollars as of the midpoint of the case, as of the day of the court's judgment, or the time of payment by the secretary to try to capture as accurately as possible the as I say, the relative value of the currency to U.S. dollars. So there's a huge degree of complexity here. And all of this is to say that in addition to the context, the data, policy, and complexity problems suggesting that Congress did not conceive of what Appellant's counsel is seeking to do when it passed the statute, there is almost no question that all of these issues would raise significant secondary major litigation around the EJIA statute. And the Supreme Court has been extremely clear in Hensley and Pierce that the point of EJIA is not to engage in major secondary litigation, and that it should be fairly easily applied. Under no system can this be easily and clearly applied. Even if all of the concerns that I've raised today are satisfied, there is still significant questions about how they're satisfied. And if we take Appellant's counsel's original system of using the UN, DOD, and State Department numbers, there is a significant question about the applicability of those numbers, the data sets used, and the calculations. I know that Appellant's counsel has argued in his reply pleading and here today that we spend, in his words, a large amount of time. I guess the phrase I would paraphrase him as using is dickering about dollars and cents. There's no question that application of the statute to an attorney living and working outside of the United States would compound any problem that we have with the parties spending their time fighting over a few dollars and cents, because there are so many questions that get involved here. With that said, I think that these all counsel against the application of the statute to an attorney living and working outside the United States, and it appears to my reading to be the reason that no other court has adopted a system where this can even be a question. That being said, I think we also need to talk about the problems that adhere in appellants, the systems that appellants have presented today, starting first with, as I say, his UNDOD State Department calculations. As Your Honor noted in appellant's presentation, there appears to be no particular reason or mathematical justification for averaging these amounts. There are other serious flaws with the use of these metrics. First, at least the State Department is extremely clear that their metrics, I believe they call them post allowances, cannot be used to compare the cost of living in one location over time. So we couldn't use the State Department post allowance adjustments for Ecuador from March of 1996 to compare to the cost of living in Ecuador right now. It's just not what the numbers are designed to do statistically. And there appears to be no reason to believe that the UN or DOD numbers would provide that metric when the State Department numbers do not. I think the other very significant problem with the use of any of these numbers is that these numbers are not they are not seeking to compensate for the cost of living increases in a foreign country. They are not seeking, to take Ecuador as an example, to compensate for the increased cost of living associated with someone living in Ecuador relative to America. They are seeking to compensate an American maintaining an American standard of living in a foreign country. So with respect, that would be all of the Ford trucks and Coca-Cola that an American would normally buy in that foreign country. It's for this reason that if you looked at the tables provided by appellant's counsel in his original pleading, none of the countries in either the UNDOD or State Department numbers have a negative adjustment. And quite frankly, it's very difficult to believe that the United States is the cheapest country in the world in which to live. It is also the reason that some of the biggest adjustments in these charts are provided to countries where import and export are extremely hard. Particularly, the Secretary noted large adjustments in island nations like the Seychelles, Turks and Caicos, and the Bahamas, or in countries with very strong currencies or very high tariffs. In particular, we noted very high adjustments for Japan, France, and Canada. So these numbers are fundamentally flawed. Lastly, there's a problem with the application of these numbers in the way that appellant's counsel has used them, because he's using these numbers to compare to the cost of living in particular points throughout the United States. However, these numbers are already based on a comparison point in the United States. In the case of the DOD and State Department numbers, they're based off the cost of living in the D.C. area. I believe in the case of the UN numbers, they're based on the cost of living in the New York area. And so when appellant's counsel uses these numbers and compares them to another point in the United States, we're kind of compounding the comparison and creating another mathematical problem. This is all to say that nothing has been said thus far about the increased costs associated with appellant's counsel living and working outside of the United States. Particularly, I would note things like postage and phone calls. If appellant's counsel sought to send a letter to his client today, and I would note that his clients in these appeals live in Texas and I believe Wisconsin. If he sought to send a letter to them today, that letter would cost him about 41 cents in postage, depending on weight. That same letter coming from Ecuador, Portugal, Russia, or any other foreign country would likely cost significantly more to send to his clients. Similarly, with phone calls, appellant's counsel making a phone call to his client today after he hangs up with the court would be a standard flat fee. An international call from Ecuador would cost significantly more. This is all to say nothing of travel expenses. If we were not living in a pandemic world and the parties were appearing in the court's courtroom today, appellant's counsel would have to appear. His costs, appellant's counsel in particular, because he lives in the D.C. region for now, would be significantly higher if he were having to appear from Ecuador, Portugal, Russia, or any other country. It's difficult to believe that Congress intended for the taxpayer to foot that bill for those increased costs. Frankly, as appellant's counsel says, just because he wants to move there. I would also point out in making this this note that appellant's counsel has asserted that the secretary's position is hurting veterans. With respect and to reference Chief Judge Bartley's earlier question, we don't believe that our position would be hurting veterans. As I think all parties have acknowledged, the world is shrinking. And right now we have many veterans who live and work outside of the United States and still obtain counsel before this court from within the country. And that's because of, as appellant's counsel says, Wi-Fi and laptops. So we don't believe that really what is happening here would be a detriment to veterans as much as it would be a detriment to this veteran's attorney, or I know he references another associate of his who may have to move at some point. So I did just want to draw that comparison. And I wanted to say that while the secretary is very cognizant of the desire to have attorneys working in this field and representing veterans, we are very aware that Congress sought to have attorneys working with the veterans. That was the purpose of extending the Aegis statute to this court. We share that purpose. We believe that it is in the veterans' best interest to have attorneys working with them. It's quite frankly, I believe, in the secretary's interest to have attorneys working with the veterans. The problem that we have here is just that the statute does not appear to be built for this world. And so we have problems that simply can't be answered right now. And Congress is the best and potentially only.
Mr. Callahan, yes. this is Judge Bartley. You just seemed to say something contrary to what you were saying earlier. It's not that the statute wasn't built for doing this. It's that there's in your view, no valid corollary to the Bureau of Labor Statistics CPI. Is that correct?
With respect, Your Honor, I would like to make a couple distinctions there. Our position is that it does not appear that the statute was, as I say, built for this world. The world in October of 1981 was a world where doing what appellant's counsel is proposing to do would have been very much more difficult, if not altogether impossible. So it doesn't appear that Congress intended the statute to apply in this way, and the world has kind of changed around this statute. So we do take the position that it doesn't appear that the statute can be applied to an attorney living and working outside the United States. We also take the position that appellant's counsel, in particular in these appeals, has not met his burden to apply the statute outside to an attorney living and working outside the United States. Lastly, I would like to clarify that it is not our position that simply because the numbers did not come from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that they are unreliable. Our position is only that because the numbers did not come from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there is a question of reliability that needs to be addressed. So as I say, we do understand the concerns of wanting veterans to have representation in seeking their benefits. We want them to have representation in seeking their benefits as well. The problem is just that the statute does not, with the court's indulgence.
Your time is up, but you can go ahead and sum up.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. As I was saying, there is simply a problem with the statute that is best and potentially only fixable by Congress. And so with that, if there are no further questions, the Secretary asks that the court reject appellant's unprecedented request for the court to apply the cost of living provision to attorneys outside the United States, and that the court reject appellant's other systems of calculation.
Judge Allen, do you have further questions?
No, I don't. Thanks.
And Judge Salvi, do you have any further questions for the Secretary?
Just a couple. If Mr. Hoffman was vacationing in Quito, what would be the and did some work on Mr. Swanigan or Mr. Terman's cases, what would be the Secretary's position on the rate for that work done there while vacationing?
Your Honor, that situation would seem to be controlled by the court's holding in, I believe it's pronounced Spigner, might be Spigner. My reading of that case is that the locality rates that are to be used are for where the attorney lives and works. Because in your hypothetical, appellant's counsel is vacationing.
So he'd get the D.C. rate.
Yes, Your Honor, because he's vacationing there and he lives and works in your hypothetical still in the D.C. area.
And if the purpose of the trip instead is to explore setting up a satellite rather than vacation, he'd still get the DC rate because that's not where he lives and works.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I believe that's a fair reading of the Spigner holding, yes.
This is Judge Bartley. I thought, but you can correct me if I'm wrong, that Spenier declined to address temporary movements, an attorney's temporary movement around the country, so that where they're not living, but they happen to be overnight somewhere.
Yes, Your Honor.
Correct, Mr. Callahan?
That is correct. I simply say that that is my reading of the Spigner holding. I'm certainly await the court's judgment on that issue. That is my reading of the holding because the attorneys at issue in Spigner were living and working in areas other than where their office was located. And in terms of the other cases that the court has approached about attorneys moving around, it has been to other offices of theirs. And so they were working from that location as part of their, you know, their firm's regular practice. So I agree that the question has never been specifically addressed, but that does appear to be that. That is my understanding of the case law thus far.
So if Mr. Hoffman was merely temporarily in Quito, exploring, setting up, staffing an office, then he should be entitled to the DC rate. Would that be correct?
Your Honor, I think that, again, that is a fair interpretation of the case law. I think that my understanding in this situation, and appellant's counsel can correct me in his rebuttal time if I'm wrong, my understanding in this situation is that that is what was happening in these charges. Appellant's counsel has not requested the DC rate, and so we think that he has not carried his burden to establish that he's entitled to fees at that rate in this case. I also would ask that the court still continue to reach the question, even to the extent that the court wants sees fit to apply the DC rate to someone who is exploring an outside office or vacationing, as your questions point to. I would still ask that the court reach this question because it's my understanding, and again, appellant's counsel can correct me, that he is intending to move to Ecuador. And so this, there is almost no question that this will be an issue. If it's not in this case, it will be in a handful of months when he moves there.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Callahan. Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
You may go ahead with rebuttal, Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to get this low-hanging fruit out of the way, I was more than exploring. I hired an attorney there. I enrolled all three of my children in school there and was planning on returning there in a few months, but for the COVID, which stopped me and my family from moving. I want to talk about Congress. I actually disagree with the secretary on whether they thought about this in 1980 when they redid it in 85 and 96. I think that they did. And the reason for that is they're already dealing at that point, all three of those points, with cases from the INS, immigration, international trade courts. There's other proof, too. If Congress did not consider this current world when it enacted EJIA in 1980, Congress is certainly aware of this current world now. Why haven't they made a change to it? Why would they have not changed it in 96 when they changed the rate? And there is proof that Congress chose not to limit cost of living increases to attorneys residing in the United States. And you can look at that just this year. The CARES Act was passed. The CARES Act explicitly forbids an attorney from that is practicing in U.S. courts and is an American citizen from getting many of the benefits in the CARES Act if that attorney is living outside of the United States. Congress knows how to exclude people outside of its borders. A blanket denial of the cost of living increases for anyone that lives abroad That's what would frustrate Congress's intent. And it's their only known intent. It is focused on the litigants and their purchasing power to pay an attorney. $125 might be enough in some countries. It's not going to be enough in Ecuador. If this court finds that it's $125 is what rate we're going to charge when we're in Ecuador or abroad, hey, we're just going to change plans, and I'm not going to go to Ecuador. This data reliability, I'm going to turn to that because this is not actually complicated math. The secretary has made this complicated by bringing in something like exchange rates. I just want to talk about how irrelevant exchange rates are. A cost of living increase is computed the same everywhere in the world. You take one location and you compare 2 points in time in that one location. It does not matter if your money is ringgits, dollars, pounds, euros. It's a percentage change. It doesn't matter what the exchange rate is. The data that I provided also, the UN data, the Department of Defense data, that data wasn't provided to show a cost of living increase. What that data does is it allows us to compare a city in America with a city outside of America and see the difference in cost of living, not the increase, but just cost of living between those two. And then if you peg that U.S. city's cost of living increase to the 96 and current rate that you're using in the El-Citizen method, if every number was right, the method would produce an exact number every single time that everyone would know is 100% correct. The reason we don't is because the data at the UN, the data at the DOD, and the data from BLS is got flaws. The only one that has admitted to the flaws is the BLS, who have made multiple statements in public, and they're in cases where they talk about this, where their data, especially regional data, has problems with sample size, and it's flawed, and there are problems. The Menino, I want to talk about Menino also. Menino in the broadest sense. Menino already allows people who have no CPI data covering where they live to bill at the regional rate. And that's because 25 million Americans living in the United States cannot be measured, where they live cannot be measured for CPI data because they're living too rurally. They live on military installations, and of course, some are in prisons where cost of living isn't regulated or important. I'm not relying on the Ecuador CPI data for my rate at all. It's just because the data I use with the UN and the DOD, comparing it to the CPI data in Washington, D.C., and for DOD, I used Anchorage, Alaska, because I was trying to use familiar points, and I lived in Anchorage for 5 years. That data is all provided just to show that the cost of living in Quito is comparable to the cost of living to those places, and it expresses a percentage of difference between my chosen U.S. point and Quito. The reason I provided the Ecuador CPI is to show, like, yeah, there's been inflation there. There has been a cost of living increase. And anyone who's been to Quito anytime recently will know the cost of living there isn't much different. Might even be more expensive than places like El Paso, maybe Indianapolis. It's not significant. It's not a third world country. And I think people might get hung up on thinking Ecuador is a third world country, and it's not. With that, excuse me.
Mr. Hoffman?
I'm sorry. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Hoffman, this is Judge Bartley. Yeah. Could you provide you said that BLS has publicly discussed, perhaps in court cases or otherwise, the flaws in their data. Could you provide the court with some of that if we ordered you to?
I think
you have that
so.
Available?
Yes, it is in Jawad v. Barnhart. And this is, by the way, Your Honor, this is the case that led directly to Tangarajaha, in the Ninth Circuit to lead them to the national rate. And do you want me to read that quote, Your Honor?
Sure. That would be great.
Okay. Give me just a moment to find it. 26. It's a very long case, Your Honor. I'm sorry. If it would be okay with the court, can I submit it after argument?
Yes, please do.
Okay. I would be happy to do that. With that, Your Honors, if I can have a minute to just summarize, and it's quick, the math is easy. This is not hard math at all, and the method is not flawed. I can't speak for the numbers from the UN, the DOD, or the BLS, but the method is solid. It would frustrate Congress's intent if a cost of living increase wasn't provided, and that's going to cause at least me, I don't know about Evan when his wife deploys what that's going to do to him, but there's a good chance if he's stuck at $125, he's going to be without a job, possibly. It depends on where he goes. This is what would frustrate Congress's intent, because it's going to take away purchasing power from litigants, because it's going to shrink the pool of litigants willing to represent them. And with that, Your Honors, we're all done, unless anyone has any questions for me.
Judge Allen, do you have further questions for Mr. Hoffman?
I don't, thank you.
And Judge Falvey?
No, I don't, thanks.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you, Your Honors.
And we thank you all very much for your arguments. The case is submitted for consideration.
The court is now in recess.